Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is Saturday, June the 3rd, 2022. It's a beautiful day in Toronto, not too hot, nice sunshine, etc. Wonderful day for a podcast, even if I am inside. And today I have two return guests, Steve Hayes, who you may know from his involvement with Fair Tax Organization, and Joe Howard in Thailand. But I think it would be best for each of my guests to introduce themselves before we get started. Steve, do you want to proceed?
Of course. Delighted to be with you again, John and Joe. My background is I am an attorney, and I consider myself a recovering tax attorney because I did that for a number of years when I first started working as a lawyer. And you never can get away from tax in this country that we have, in fact, all around the world. But I worked for a long time, and that got very disillusioned because it was totally, I believe, wasting a lot of time and effort, and different people were getting different results based upon how well they could pay a tax representative or if they could lobby Congress to get different results. And it just seemed unfair. So I got involved with, in 1990, with a movement to get rid of the income tax and replace it with a retail sales tax, a national retail sales tax. That organization became Americans for Fair Taxation, which is promoting the fair tax. And our website is fairtax.org. So that's a bit about me.
Okay, and maybe just add right now, I mean, we'll undoubtedly get to this, but I think this is extremely important. Can you give sort of the Reader's Digest version of the Reader's Digest version of what you mean by replacing the income tax with some kind of a retail sales tax?
Well, presently, we've got a situation that every government throughout history has faced, and that is it has an obligation to provide certain duties, perform certain duties, provide certain services to its populace. Early on, it was primarily protecting it. But there have been levies of different kinds, and there are two basic areas that governments can use, or a combination of both. One is the direct tax, where it says, okay, everybody has to pay like a poll tax. It's a direct tax. John, you got to pay it no matter what. Joe, you got to pay it. Steve, you got to pay it. And an income tax, which is a direct tax from the government to each of us. The other alternative is an indirect tax. And that's a tax you pay like an excise tax. You pay an excise tax. That's all a sales tax is. It's a paid on the excise part, the part of the price. It's based on the price. It's indirect because the government doesn't have a line directly to you to collect the tax. Instead, it collects the tax from a third party, you know, like a retail store. So those are the two forms. For a long time in this country, we used different indirect taxes. We had excise taxes. First rebellion was on the whiskey excise tax in 1793. So you have all of these different taxes that have been done, but it's mostly we operated with tariffs, custom fees, excise taxes, and the states collected the same. And then it became, quote, unfair to not tax people making more income. And so the idea was, we're going to fund the government. We're still going to keep tariffs. We're still going to keep customs duties. We're still going to keep excise taxes on certain things. But what we're going to do is add a direct tax, which is the income tax. That was prohibited in the Constitution unless you did it per capita. In other words, you had to do it in a way that would reflect each state. And that was considered not really doable because it wasn't directly on each one of us. So and therefore, we passed
to there for 1 second, Steve.
Yeah.
This, I think this may be a great moment. You had sent over an article written in the 1990s by Steve Hayes and the great tax historian Charles Adams. And,
yes.
You know, it was a great article, and thank you for sending it. And I think it's worth a podcast in and of itself. But as I listen to you talk, I'd like to read in this particular paragraph from the article.
Sure.
And for listeners, this is sort of an imaginary scenario where Thomas Jefferson wakes up after hundreds of years and knocks on Steve Hayes' front door, for example, has a conversation. But it says, in a sad voice, Jefferson says, when we wrote the Constitution, all of us knew history. We knew that great civilizations began to decline when they introduced direct taxation. In the Constitution, we restricted direct taxation because we knew it would yield the same result experienced by other nations. Using direct taxation, erosion of individual rights, and the oppression of the minority by the majority because it could use its political power to use the government to steal from the minority.
Exactly what has happened since 1913. You've got a situation where because an act that was characterized as only applying to the most wealthy people in its first iteration in 1913, it did have limits which pretty much untaxed most people. However, a couple of years later, and particularly when World War I came, everybody was now taxed. You know, it'd been the bait and switch. We're only going to do it this far. And here we are. Now everybody is being taxed. And that's what happens with a direct tax. You have the ability to modify it at will. And the other part about it that really makes it oppressive to our rights, John and Joe, is that a direct tax, the rules are only applicable as long as Congress and the president says they are. Now, that's true with any tax. But instead of having to change the rate of taxation, like in Toronto, you have a goods and services tax, I believe. Instead of having to change the goods and services tax pretty broadly, where everybody sees it, with an income tax, you can go back and you can say, okay, John, you live in Toronto. You're one of those people that we're going to tax differently than Steve. We weren't going to in the past, but we've decided it makes sense to do it now. They can target a reform just on you. And they have. But worst part of this is that you can say, okay, here is the tax system to which I'm subject. And you arrange your affairs, you make plans, and you live your life. And then lo and behold, 2 years later, a new Congress, a new president, whatever comes in, and they say, well, you know, we used to say that up to this amount of money, John, you didn't have to pay U.S. tax. But we decided that's not, quote, fair. So we're going to reduce that limit so that now your tax burden has gone up 10, 15, 20% because Congress changed their mind. And right now you have introduced in Congress bills that would take, let me give you an example, another example that maybe applies to a lot of your listeners. Let's say you have a retirement plan and you've contributed into that retirement plan and it's been kind of a contract you thought you had. I'm going to put this money in this plan. It's going to be restricted where I can't just go get it. But in return for that, it's going to grow tax-free. It's only going to be taxed to me when I take it out. And presumably my tax level will be lower. so it'll be at less tax than when I'm making more money. Okay, very familiar. It's a promise that was made repeatedly. There have been recent attempts from certain progressives to say, well, that is okay if the amount of money in that retirement account is $200,000. But if it's over that, then the wealthy are taking advantage of everybody else. So therefore, we're going to break that covenant that we made with John and Joe and Steve. And we're going to start taxing currently the income over 200,000. And it's not just going to be the acknowledged income, but it's going to require the trustee to say, okay, that account has grown $30,000 in appreciation, and we're going to tax that $30,000 of growth. Of course, in the last few months, we've seen what happened to the stock market, and a lot of people who might have had that $30,000 appreciation maybe have a $30,000 loss in their value of their account. They don't worry about that. But that's the problem with direct taxation. Because it can be targeted to certain classes of people, the rules can be changed at any time.
Well,
if we do not obey our betters and not protest too loud, they'll leave us alone maybe. But if we stick our hands up and say, wait a minute, we don't think you're doing the right thing, we could end up with being taxed, or we could end up with a visit from the tax authority. And it's just so simple, they just simply pass the rule on the IRS. You need to change it. You need to look at people involved in these types of activities. That's why we had all the conservative groups unable to get tax exempt status for so long, because they fit in this category. And so it can become a tax whip that takes away personal liberty, takes away First Amendment rights, and actually can reduce Second Amendment rights, because there's even talk about taxing people with firearms differently. And so you've got a real threat to our civil liberties. And I'm sorry I stopped you, but I wanted to get that in.
No, that's a great, very important point. Now, before we bring Joe into the conversation, I mean, you know, as always, you said so many fascinating things. You know, we could go on for days. But to summarize one point that she made, would you agree that I think part of what you're saying is that these things that start out as class taxes always become mass taxes?
Yes.
You know, we see examples of, you know, the alternative minimum tax and all those. The second thing is this. I mean, it's always interesting to hear you talk, you know, from the perspective of, you call yourself a recovering tax lawyer, but I think maybe, you know, once you're a tax lawyer, you know, you can kind of take the tax out of the lawyer, but you can never take a lawyer out of the tax.
Very difficult. Sort of like the alcoholic. That's why I'm recovering.
Exactly. But the thing is this, that if somebody were listening to that, they might not understand all the intricacies, but would you agree that with the direct tax, the income tax, basically the government can steal from you a million different ways. You can find 10 of them, you're doing well.
Well, yeah, and it's like all under the guise of funding the government. Let's strip it back. And if the only way to fund the government effectively was to do a direct tax, there might be some justification for it. I mean, realistically, there might be a justification like in wartime or something. We've got to raise a bunch of money quick and we're going to do it this way. But if you have an alternative, and frankly, for hundreds of years, collecting retail sales taxes was done, in fact, in my lifetime, and probably not in Joe's, but maybe in yours, John, you would go to the counter to buy something and they would ring it up on a cash register. And you'd give them cash because we didn't really have credit cards. And they give you back cash. And there was no reporting, you know, basically electronically. So there would be a huge amount of evasion by store owners that wouldn't report their sales properly, or John's a friend of mine, I'm not going to charge him tax or whatever. Now we've got a system where 92%, or maybe even higher today, of all the retail sales in this country is done by less than 8% of the merchants. 92%.
That's an extraordinary statement. So, I mean, you know, I want to move that from the theoretical. So mm-hmm. I think what I understood you to say, and correct me if I'm wrong, that 92% of retail sales has gone through things like Amazon, Home Depot.
Absolutely.
You know, it's, I mean, that's unbelievable.
Yep. Well, and also, you know, look at the big car dealer, you know, the car dealers, the people that have to register their sale in order to get a car tag. But 92% of the retail sales, and the people that do the retail sales, like the Walmart, the Amazon, et cetera, Target, they have such precision reporting for inventory and everything that if they evade tax, it's simply an oversight. It's some kind of a glitch.
It's a software glitch.
Yeah, and it's easily fixed and corrected because they've got so many records. They've got, in most cases, these guys are hooked up directly to the state's offices that collect the tax, like the Board of Equalization in California gets hourly remittances from Walmart, for example. They're the ones that collect the state sales tax. That's why when you talk to the states, you'll find that they have an incredibly low evasion rate of sales tax, because so much of it's being reported. If it were 8% of the, I mean, 92% of the other people were reporting 8% of the tax, in order to have 8% evasion, they'd all have to evade 100%. That's not going to happen. There's too many ways to track inventory. You know, they have algorithms set up. They say, John has a business of reselling art, and he buys it from Joe. Well, John buys it from Joe. He has a resale permit, so he doesn't pay state sales tax, so he's going to sell it, and he sells it to Steve. Very easy for them to look at how much you bought and how much you said you sold. And they have algorithms that compare this to people in similar situations. And if your shrinkage and your sales are not up to a point, they do an audit. They come in and look. It's very difficult to evade the sales tax on any meaningful amount. Sure, some of it can be, you know, and it does happen. You have a convenience store. Do you think the guy is going to pay sales tax and tax on the desserts he takes home for his family? Some cases, maybe, but a lot of cases, it's probably shrinkage.
I didn't even think of that, actually. You know, it wouldn't be a case of evasion. It would simply be a case of, you know, not understanding the rule, you know, figuring out.
And that's probably the case, but if he does that too much, they're going to catch you because they know what all the other stores are buying and how much they're reporting selling. And so you've got, like in California, they've done studies on how much of their state sales tax is evaded. It's like 2 to 2.5%. And a lot of that, they believe, is actually, like you said, mistakes. You know, just they didn't realize they were supposed to do it.
Perfect compliance is perfectly impossible. I mean, yes. I think I agree with that, right?
Yes, of course. But their state income tax is probably in the 10 to 15% range that they admit on the evasion. And frankly, in the U.S., you know, Reddick, the commissioner, has admitted it's over $1 trillion, John and Joe. $1 trillion of money that should have been paid in income tax is not being collected. Almost all of that isn't from the drug lord. It's from people who come to your house to fix your plumbing and take cash. It's from people who underreport their income if they make a sale. It's from people who exaggerate, and this is probably the biggest one, exaggerate deductions. I mean, there are blogs, I'm not sure they're still there, but I bet they are, with people who are doing Uber and other types of independent contractor things, where they advise people, well, the one way you can lower your income tax is you write off all of your apartment rent as an office. And your chances of being audited are so low that, you know, you got a better chance to get hit by a bus. I don't think he used that same analogy, but that's pretty much the case. So here's a guy that's writing off $800 a month as office expense when he's using a corner of one part of his living room with a desk and legally should have written off $50 a month. See what I'm saying? He's writing off all of his telephone. He's writing off all of his computer expense. Everything, whereas in reality, it should have been written off proportionate to business and personal use. So, and a lot of that's just, as you pointed out earlier, ignorance, because it's an incomprehensible tax code.
Yeah, exactly.
But a lot of it is actually intended, and a lot of it comes about because they go work, they make this money, there's no withholding. Like a lot of us when we were young, we got money in our pocket, we're rich. We're going to go buy something. We're going to do this. And then all of a sudden it comes time to file their taxes and they can't pay them. So instead of, oh my gosh, they go, how can I reduce it? And that's when they start adding in deductions and they bring their taxes down. Okay. Because remember, on their gross income, they're not employees, and in the U.S., they're paying 15.3% flat.
Self-employment.
For Social Security, self-employment. It doesn't matter what their family size or anything is, their age, anything. They're going to pay 15.3%. And on 60 grand, that's 9 grand.
It's a lot of money.
And a lot of them don't have it. But if they can reduce their income down to 20,000, it's only 3 grand. Big incentive to add deductions.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me that, you know, as always, you're saying a lot of different things, but I just want to pull out one theme that keeps repeating itself, although perhaps not in these words exactly. That if you're a country that's concerned about the integrity of your tax system, you're an awful lot better off running it through some kind of a sales tax than through an
absolutely tax,
because it's so much simpler. There's so much less room for complexity, lack of understanding. And, we will refer to Commissioner Reddick's $1 trillion, but we'll call it more politely leakage. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, but I think it may even go back to your first point that you were talking about human rights and about rights of citizens and our basic rights. If you have a system where it has become okay to disregard a law because it's inconvenient, where does that stop, John and Joe? If it's okay to avoid the income tax law, is it okay to avoid other laws? Is it okay to be a criminal because you have an insane tax system that you could easily change? Is it okay to make criminals that way? Well, and I think from a moral point of view, there's a huge argument that says we want everybody to be able to live their life and we don't want to create criminals.
Well, you know,
we're doing that.
That makes a lot of sense to me. And when I look at North American society, and I, by the way, I'm including Canada and everything I say about the United States and probably the UK, as well. But, you know, there's always this discussion about the high crime rate. Well, you know, it seems to me the easiest way to fix the crime rate is to stop defining laws that are not really crimes as crimes.
Right.
Form laws where compliance is so difficult that people inadvertently become criminals, right?
Right. That's exactly right. And I think that's a huge reason from an ethical and moral rights point of view of why you want to switch from an income tax to a sales tax, because then that Uber driver, when he got all that cash in his pocket and he went out and bought that new stereo, he paid his sales tax. And come April, it's just another day. He's already paid all of his taxes. He doesn't have to fudge on the internet or whatever, you know, his office rent, okay? He has paid his taxes and he's done. And he doesn't have to look over his shoulder for the next 5 to 10 years.
And it's been simple. I mean, there's a saying, simplicity is virtue. Mm-hmm. I think that's true generally in life, but I think particularly true in the case of taxation. Joe, what are your thoughts on this, particularly on the morality of the tax system in terms of the things that Steve is talking about? Does it create noncompliance? Does it create more criminals than we might normally have? What are your thoughts?
When it comes to crimes, see, I'm a former law.
A brief introduction. We missed you on the brief introduction.
Okay. I'm Joe Howard. I am an American living in Thailand. I'm originally from Ohio. I'm a former federal law enforcement officer and soldier, and I advocate for Americans abroad. Talking about creating criminals. Everyone's a criminal just because of what the law says. These laws are created to create criminals because the system makes money off of these laws, these crimes. And it's no different from the tax law. It's so hard to comply with something that's difficult to understand. And if it's too difficult to understand, you have a tough time complying with it, and you screw up, and you don't mean to. You try to do your best, but you know you screw up, and then you get punished for it. And like, for example, Americans abroad, a lot of us, we try to comply, but it's impossible. And when it comes to actually paying the tax from abroad, those are not taxes. Those are penalties, because we are charged penalties for this screw up that we have no knowledge of. So I think the system is there to create the criminals.
Well, that's an interesting point of view, Joe, because it actually makes a lot of sense, because all of this, you know, and I think as a law enforcement officer, my dad was a county sheriff, so I grew up in a law enforcement family. And one of the things that was always so clear to my dad, and he talked about to us, is that the laws were often written in such a general way that John could look at my conduct and say, well, there's nothing wrong with that. But Joe could look at it and go, gosh, that's against the law, because it's not defined. And it's like, you know, I look at all of these things, like what is a legitimate business expense? John could say that the time he spent talking with me on this podcast was time that, you know, was allocated to business and therefore all deducted. Probably everybody would agree with that, even in Canada, okay, that it would be an expense. But, you know, Joe could look at it and say, no, because we really didn't talk about things relevant to, and this is a little weird example, but to John's business. Because under the income tax laws, in order to be deductible in the U.S., it has to be for business purposes, okay? You know, maybe a better example is, and when I was doing tax work, I used to have these arguments all the time with auditors. What is a business expense? What's a business lunch? What do you have to do to qualify? Well, you'd have one auditor that said, you had lunch with John, He's a client, no problem. You have another auditor who would say, well, you have to tell me how much of that lunch you spent talking business. And you can only deduct that portion. And you have to show me some note or I'm going to disallow the whole thing. I'm serious. It's so general. And anytime you have something general that can be interpreted many different ways, you have a situation where legitimately John could think it was a business thing. And what he got from that 10 minutes of our lunch was incredibly valuable. That's why he deducted it. And the auditor can look at it and say, no, they were talking about their kids primarily. It's not business. How absurd is that? If you had a simple sales tax, you eliminate 90% of that. Well, you eliminate it all for people who are living their lives and they're not running a business. It's all gone. You don't have that issue. You don't have to keep records. Why? Because you have paid all of your taxes at the point of purchase for retail, new goods, and retail services. No records are required. You don't send the government a report. And this is what's crazy to me. They come back and they say, well, we want all this information. And like John had pointed out before the show, you know, they just got tired, thought they could never catch up, and they destroyed 30 million information returns, right? And no reason except they didn't want to, okay? And now they're caught and they're trying to explain it and they can't. But it's an indication of just how impossible this system is. And it's not because the IRS is evil. There may be people in there that are, let's just say, people I wouldn't want to have dinner with. But for the most part, they've got an impossible job. You know, how do you collect an incomprehensible tax situation system?
You know, on that point, I think Steve, but probably Joe would agree. I mean, for years, I've been of the view that the IRS is actually the single biggest victim of this whole system, the single biggest.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can you imagine? I mean, even domestically, you know, the thing is beyond sane with the complexity. But then, you know, in the world that Joe and I think more about, you know, the whole American abroad thing. I mean, compliance is completely impossible. It is beyond my comprehension that anything other than a minuscule percentage of the people charged with administering the tax code in relation to American abroad could possibly understand it. And I think that the best overall argument for tax reform is to stop persecuting the IRS.
Yes. Yeah. They're the tar baby, as we used to say in the South. They're the ones that Congress points to, you know, and it's like, remember Casablanca, where Claude Rains, you know, was the police inspector, and it may be before you, Joe, but it was a classic Humphrey Bogart movie made during World War II. And they're in his bar and he has gambling casino, and the inspector, Renault, I believe, whatever, Claude Rains' character, is ordered by the Germans to shut it down. And he says, we're shutting you down. And the Humphrey Bogart, Rick, comes over and says, why? And he says, well, there's gambling here. You know, I didn't know there was gambling here. And then a lady walks up and says, Inspector, here's your winnings from the roulette. And that is the way they treat the IRS. It's always the IRS's fault. It's never their fault. It's always this terrible thing the IRS did. But they don't, you know, if you're going to do this, you're going to have to increase the funding maybe 10 times, literally, because you've got to bring their computer system into the modern age. You've got to hire more people. You got to do more audits. You've got to be more oppressive if you're going to collect it. Otherwise, there's no way. And then on top of this, they start, as opposed to sending things, enacting laws, and having to have somebody else enforce it, they put it on the IRS. It's the IRS that gives the child credit. It's the IRS that, you know, under an income tax credit. All of these things that cripple the IRS. And when I first started working with them, when I would go into a tax audit, it was not uncommon, particularly in a business audit, to walk in and meet someone who had not only a degree in accounting, but a master's in accounting on the other side for the IRS. I mean, I've had CPAs who work for the IRS in these audits. I've had one audit, we had an actual tax attorney present for the IRS, you know, work for the IRS. So you had a very, very high skill level. And they're having a terrible time, according to people that I know that still do it, keeping those kinds of people because they don't, A, pay them enough, and B, a lot of them have retired, and now they're hiring people. You saw, maybe you didn't see, but there was this big thing at a job fair. They hired all these people who walked in, okay, and there wasn't even a requirement in many cases to have a college degree. And they teach them to be an auditor because they send them to a, I think it's remotely, but anyway, to a class for 2 weeks.
2 weeks to learn how
in accounting. And so there you get somebody coming in. And that's why you have, I hear this all the time, you have this audit agent. And honestly, I used to appreciate the fact that we had very skilled people because we weren't trying to pull anything. But you could actually explain things and they would duplicate it. You go to these other people who have no real accounting background and probably don't have a lot of time doing it. And they are facing somebody who's like me in the old days, but is, you know, a tax professional. They're way overmatched. They don't have a clue. And so what do? They say, Joe, we don't believe that that money you paid in Thailand or whatever is legitimate. We're going to disallow that as a deduction. You're going to owe an extra $5,000 in tax or $4,000 or whatever. Arbitrarily, you say, wait a minute. How can you say that? Here are the checks that were paid. Here's the receipts. I'm disallowing it because it's not okay. All right. And now you've got a situation. Do you keep paying someone $600 an hour to fight them? Or do you say, see what the best settlement you can get is? And you're probably going to be, once you calm down, you're probably going to say, what's the best you can get? The guy goes back to the agent. The agent says $3,000. And you say, pay it. I'll pay it. Just to get rid of it. It's not legitimate. It's extortion. But it's like people in the U.S., maybe you guys get them too, but they'll get a statement from the IRS saying, you owe another $1,250 in tax, John, because you failed to report blah, blah, blah. And you say, but I did report it. You call up your tax preparer. Here's my receipts. The tax preparer is likely going to tell you, John, just pay it.
Yeah.
You can't afford to get into a fight with a computer and pay me. Just pay it. Just be done. Go on with your life and live it. And that's really how it's evolved into. And it's not even necessarily, it's all that evil. It's just the reality of what they're dealing with.
Well, I suppose because there are so few of them relative to the issues that there's no other way to get these things off their books, I suppose, at the end of the day.
And that's the thing. They used to be compensated or rated based upon how much money they collected. Now, because of all the heat from all of the taxpayers, they've now unofficially, even though maybe there's still some of that, have gone to completed cases. So the more cases they can close, the quicker, the better. That's why they're not auditing all these complex people. It's not because, you know, they're trying to avoid wealthy people. It's because a wealthy person's audit may take 6 months to a year. Whereas if they go after a lower income person, they could close it. They can say, all right, you owe an extra $300. And the guy goes, oh, all right, it's closed. So he can close 100 in the same time that he would perhaps close one of the more wealthy people. And so that's why, you know, when you see that percentage, I mean, their Congress was saying, oh my gosh, it's terrible. They're auditing a lot more low-income people than high-income people. It's logical if you're going to rate them on, you know, cases closed. You know, here's a guy who's very good and he goes out and he collects some money from a high-income person, but it takes him 9 months to get it done. He's not going to rate as high maybe as the other guy that collected $100 here and $200 here from 100 other low-income taxpayers.
Well, it also strikes me, though, that, you know, if you talk about, I'm understanding you say that you perceive a relative decline in the technical competence.
Not even, yes. I mean, relative, yes, and probably steep.
Okay, well, so with a decline, they're going to lose the ability to, you know, really go after anything more complex anyway, right? I mean, you know, you have to have a certain skill level.
Yes.
Be able to audit a certain kind of individual, right?
But they do. But remember, if you go to a high income person and you pull one of these, like I mentioned before, you know, this person's making $500,000 a year. And you come and you say, all right, we're going to disallow these deductions. You owe 10 grand more in tax. Arbitrarily. There is a point there where the guy is going to say, all right, what can you settle for? Let's move on. And they're going to collect 7-8 grand and move on. Because it's a system that fosters extortion. It's a system where it's assumed that everybody is cheating if they can. And they're supposed to go out and catch those people that aren't paying their, quote, fair share. And it's just not working, and it's not going to work, and it's only going to become worse as we get more crypto. And then they're going to have, there's a new 1099 that's going to go out, which hopefully will not apply to you. But if you pay your babysitter, as an example, using Venmo or one of the other, PayPal, one of the other services, PayPal is supposed to report to the IRS and send you a 1099 to the person receiving it and the person paying it, you know, an indication to the IRS that John paid Joe $4,000 last year, $5,000. And John may have paid Joe to buy a, you know, a fishing boat motor. All right. But you now have the assumption is if it was paid to Joe, he was performing services. A, why wasn't he an employee, particularly for like for babysitting, for cleaning your house? They're supposed to be on payroll. So you're going to have a lot of people getting dunned for Social Security, you know, payroll taxes and income taxes that were not withheld because the girl receiving it didn't file his income if she was the babysitter.
So really,
that's more paperwork for the IRS. And I'm sure
it's going to become,
that will be destroyed as well.
That's right. Well, it's going to become, again, another layer of complexity they have to deal with when they can't deal with what they have. So they're going to arbitrarily send you a notice. I think I may have mentioned this to John, but I moved out of California in 2006, closed my law office, everything. I got a final notice of levy from the state of California franchise tax in 2018. And I said, what's it about? And it was for what they had done is their computer had decided that based on my prior, and I don't know why they picked 2010, but in 2010, my law firm owed I think it was 15 or 12,000 initially, but with interest and penalties, it had grown to 20. They just put it in. The computer generated it. I wasn't even there. I didn't even have a law firm. Okay. And I said, well, this makes no sense, but this was a final notice to levy. Now, a levy is where they attach a lien on your property. Now, I know how to get rid of them. That they probably weren't going to be successful with me and have any fun, but it would have cost me lots and lots of time and effort to do that. I contacted them, of course, got hung up on, couldn't get through, called one of my friends who still does tax work. He gave me a backlines number. And of course, I call it, how did you get this number type thing? And I said, well, I had it from before and blah, blah, blah. First lady, I explained everything. She says, fax me over, you know, the evidence, you know, no company, all of this stuff. Well, they could get it off the Secretary of State in California, but I'm supposed to provide it. I send it all over. 2 months later, I get another final notice of levy, filing a lien. I call up my backline's number. I get this lady. She happens to be nicer than the first one. And I talk to her and I tell her I sent all this. She puts me on hold and it's gone like 5 minutes, comes back. No, we don't have any record. Sorry, the lien's going forward. And I said, wait a minute. If this was provided to you, and I told her I'd make her a deal. I said, if you provide me, if you get me the 100,000, right now you're saying I owe 20. You get me the 100,000 you say I made, and I'll split it with you. You get 50, not 20, and I get 50. How about that? And she starts laughing. And she goes, okay. And I said, will you stay on the line while I fax all this over? You can't email it. You got to fax it. I sent it to her, and I haven't received any other notices of levy. But I could get another one tomorrow. Who knows? It's because, and one of the things that was most telling is the first lady says, well, listen, our computer is never wrong. Okay. What do you say to that? You know, it was wrong in this case. And that's the way that the IRS, that's their dream, is to have a computer system that allows them, for Joe and for John and for Steve, to calculate based on the information they've received and then send us a bill.
The U.S. government's computer system just doesn't work, even for the job, for jobs they hire for, because I went through them dozens of times and I had trouble with it. So, and their computer system sucks.
No, it's not. But their dream is to create a system that literally can do that. And of course, I've talked to members of Congress that were proposing this, and I said, but it's, you know, you're going to get all of my data. You know, they were trying to sneak in a provision where everybody who had a bank account with over $600 in it, that all the transactions had to be shared with the IRS. And then the IRS would determine how much of that was income and whatever. Okay. And it got, you know, it blew up and everybody. And of course, the Congress says, oh, my gosh, you mean there's gambling there? You know, that type of thing. Well, it's the IRS's fault. It's not ours. And it stopped. But ask those people who had their tax returns linked how confident you are that your information will be private.
Well, all of these are arguments to get it to end this current system.
That's right. There is
possible, Steve, to have the tax system that we have and still have any regard at all for human rights?
Not if you're going to collect it.
So I mean,
that's the problem.
Isn't the starting point here? You know, taxation's been as old as time, but it seems to me that what's happened is the tax system has evolved so much more than tax. You know, it's now the one-stop place, you know, for the distribution of benefits, to reward people, to punish people. Probably China, to give them a social media score, you know, through the tax system, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So You know, it seems to me that because, and I even think that the Internal Revenue Code is the unofficial constitution of the United States. I mean, that's
very clever.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you want to have a society with any regard for human rights, the dignity of the individual, then it seems to me you've got to end this particular system. Would you agree?
I 100% agree. And I felt this way for over 30 years because I saw the abuses that were going on, not all intentional, but because the system is not going to work and it's becoming less and less likely to work as we go forward. And when I say work, to collect the money that government needs in the least disruptive way to the economy and the least intrusive on our all of our rights. I mean, that should be, that's what Charles used to talk about. Societies that had tax systems that operated in that way existed for 1,000 years. Rome did. It was only when they started going to more direct taxation, remember his book,
his book is one of the greatest books ever written. For listeners, and Charles W. Adams, For Good and Evil, Taxes, yes. Right, something about taxes and the role of civilization or something like that.
Something like that. And basically, that has been true in history, and that's why we've said that from Jefferson, who really did know history. You know, it was not unthinkable when they wrote the Constitution that you could use a direct income tax. Why? Because France had one. England went to one to fund the Napoleonic Wars. This was not a new concept. This has been around a long time. There were, I believe, on one Egyptian tomb, there was a reference to a direct tax on income from Charles's book. I'm trying to remember whether it was Egypt or whether it was the Syrians, but somebody back there.
I think it was one of the hieroglyphics.
And basically you have a situation where we're repeating the same thing. And I actually wrote an article on Marx because I read a book about Marx. Marx actually believed that people should be treated based on what their value was. In other words, what they produced. And it was okay to make more money if you were producing more. That got distorted. You know, he came from an area in Germany in the 1840s where the feudal groups, but they still were, they weren't feudal then, but the ruling class carved out huge exceptions on themselves and made all of the lower classes pay the taxes. That's what's happening in France. So his idea of a progressive income tax was to try to balance the books because the way it was being done was so inequitable. What we're proposing is a retail sales tax that has a credit or prebate so that people making up to $34,000 a year with a family of four, probably 36 this year with inflation, are not going to pay any of the fair tax. So they're going to make all these purchases before they pay a dime of tax. And that's if they buy new goods. Now, how many people you know with a family of four that make $36,000 a year buy their kids new toys?
Yeah.
How many people do you know that make $36,000 a year with two kids buy new cars? Everything that's bought used is not taxable. And the other point that's really important is that if you take the tax component out of all the prices, prices can come down. Competition can drive prices down because everybody who helped produce a product had to pay Social Security for their workers. They had to pay income taxes if they were making money, and they had to increase the price enough to do that. It's somewhere between 10 and 20%. Depending on how much labor was involved and how many steps, that the price can come down. So they get more power. And under the current system, if they're making, let's say 30, because I can do the math easier, they're going to pay 7 point, if they're working for somebody, 7.65% or $2,200 in payroll taxes. So they're getting less benefit for the lower income under the present system than they would otherwise, because they're not only paying payroll taxes, they're paying more for goods and services than they should be. So their actual value in spendable money goes up from currently $30,000 to maybe $33,000,
$34,000. To be clear, part of what you're saying, I think this needs to be understood, and also I want to make sure I am understanding this correctly. Mm-hmm. You're emphasizing, okay, that the fair tax proposal gets rid of all those other kinds of taxes.
Yes.
Right, as well as the income tax, and that's why yes. So well and so simply. Just sort of anecdotally on that, when Canada moved to its national value added tax in 1991, mm-hmm. interestingly, price of goods fell.
Yes.
Because I remember very, very clearly, I was looking at buying a car at that time. And I can't remember the exact month this new law came into effect, but it was like, month one, the car was a couple thousand dollars more. Then all of a sudden, this new law comes into effect. It's it's less, right?
Right.
So, I mean, this is real. There's no question about the validity of what you're talking about. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's economically, they can't argue with it. I mean, I haven't had anybody argue with those kind of points, or the economy would grow better, that it would be better for the U.S. in terms of exports, because where you have a value-added tax, you make an export, you rebate the tax at the border. When we export in the U.S., we keep all the tax in, and so the price goes over to compete 10, 15, 20% higher than it would otherwise need to be. They add their value added tax when it gets there. When they send products over here, they come over here at maybe 80% of what they would sell for in the exporting country.
You would agree,
compete with us.
You would agree, I presume, that moving to the fair tax proposal, the sales tax, would greatly improve the flow of immigration into the United States, using the U.S. to sell into foreign markets. I mean, it just seems to me it would make the United States so much more competitive. And I think we've talked about this
huge.
The rest of the world.
Huge.
So, in other words, you look upside down, sideways, diagonally, eyes open, eyes closed. There's no doubt this is a better system. So, Steve, I got to ask you. I know how passionate you are, and you make the case extremely well and persuasively. Why the reluctance?
It goes against DC because it's a huge source of money for their friends by lobbying for benefits. They get a lot of donations through it that they fear they wouldn't get as easily. There's a huge industry built around tax preparation that, like the, like the buggy whip industry before the cars came in. And you've got a lot of people who really like the idea of us being a little afraid of the bureaucrats, because they could change the rules on us. They could sick the IRS on us. If you go to a retail sales tax, all that goes away. All of it goes away. Now, John and Joe, there is a light shining that I don't believe is an incoming train, but I think it's actually a light. And that is that we've had 22 states this year in the United States that have cut income tax and tried to eliminate their income tax. Why? Not because the bureaucrats didn't think they knew better how to spend the money, but because they were getting their butts kicked by the states around them that had gotten rid of the income tax and were much more conducive for business to come and for people to come and provide the workforce. So you've got this huge trend going on. We've got three states that have introduced legislation to mimic the national fair tax at the state tax level. Get rid of their income tax, broaden their base, give a prebate type thing so that the lower income people are not prejudiced against it, not harmed, but allow their state economically to compete with Tennessee, with Texas, with Florida, because the tax system is a part, a major part, of attracting workers and also attracting business.
Well, it certainly is. And on a somewhat related note, I'm curious what you think of, Secretary Yellen's proposal to, this global minimum tax. Right. In other words, let's force the rest of the world to increase the expenses the corporations have so that American corporations aren't at the competitive disadvantage we've imposed on them because of our high taxes, right?
I think it's typical, a bureaucratic thing that they know how better to use the money than we do. That's number one. And number two, and I had an interview on one of the cable TV shows, and they thought it would be fun to surprise me by having an economist from, I think it was New York University, on to debate me. They didn't tell me, I was just gonna be a guest. And this guy comes on and he's advocating increasing the corporate income tax and the international tax, he was all for it. And I said, and the reason you're doing that is why? And he says, well, I think it's fair corporations pay. And I said, well, let me ask you a question. Do you have a retirement plan? Obviously, working for university does. And I said, how much of that retirement plan is invested in common stock? And he paused a minute and he says, I don't know, 70%, 80%. And I said, okay, how does the value of common stock get determined? I said, you're an economist. It's based on earnings, right? Should be. That's what historically it always comes down to. And then the value of the company. Well, if you've increased their cost 15, 20%, and they can't put it all into increased prices that we're going to pay individually, what happens to their stock value? Well, it's going to go down. Well, what happens to the value of your retirement plan? It's going to go down. He wasn't very happy with this, but he answered it truthfully to his credit. And that's one of the problems that the Democrats don't sow is that if Amazon has to pay 15% more tax, they're going to resist mightily paying that. So they're going to try to increase the cost to us. They're going to try to cut down their workforce cost, or they're going to see their profits shrink. It's only three places they can get the money.
Maybe one could put it a somewhat different way. Because corporations have no personal expenses, any form of taxation is an increased cost on the corporation.
That's right. Yeah, no, and that's the point that he came to, because everybody that he supposedly represents out there, the middle income people, all have in their retirement plans these stocks that are going to be coming down if you put more tax on. Plus, all of those people, him included, you and I included, who buy their goods are going to have some part of that tax we're going to pay in increased prices.
Do you think that the reason for the resistance to getting rid of, maybe the income tax is important to give Congress something to do? Do you think that's
why? Well, I think they have a lot to do, but the thing about the income tax is they can bury things much more so in the income tax. If they're going to pass a bill that says every family in America gets X dollars of child credit, which they can do with a sales tax. They can say, we're going to give every family in America $3,000. It's a bill. It's on the table. Everybody sees it. It's not buried in the tax code.
Right.
It can easily be done, because all they've got to do is they look at the form you filed under the fair tax, which said how many people are in your family. And you say, I have two children. So what they do is they have Social Security Administration, which is going to electronically send the money every month. they have them, the prebate, they have them increase it by enough to cover the tax credit. If it's $3,000, it's $250 a month, right? So instead of having to wait a year to get the benefit of it, you get it each month. It's very simple. You want to do a COVID help to every family. You increase the prebate by that amount. Simple. You don't need an IRS to get mixed up in doing it or get backlogged and not get to it for a year. It's done electronically, and it takes whatever time it takes to electronically move it over to the program.
Yeah, and another benefit. Yeah, another benefit I see with the Fair Tax Act is the fact that not only does it not tax used goods, but a lot of people will be looking to buy used goods, which means people will be recycling more as well.
That's right. Huge point, Joe. And that's been pointed out by some environmentalist groups that I've talked to, is that it makes used goods much more valuable than they are today, because they're going to be taxed differently. You know, they're going to have an incentive of 23% for you to buy a used car and not a new car. Now, you and I, Joe, might buy used cars. John's probably going to buy new cars. Well, he's going to pay the tax because he has to have a new car. But we elect not to. And so we determine how much tax we pay, don't we? By how much we spend. If I buy my grandkids' toys at a garage sale, I don't pay any tax under the fair tax. If I go to Target and buy it, I pay the tax, right? My grandkids are getting to an age where they may start noticing that it's used, but up until they got to that age, they didn't have a clue. It was a toy, you know? And that is just my choice, though. It's my choice. It isn't some bureaucrat in DC saying, here's how much tax you should pay. It's my choice. It's up to me.
This is fantastic stuff. I mean, every time I talk to you, Steve, I have this vision, this imaging of a better future.
It is going to be, it's going to happen.
Humanity.
No, John, it's going to happen because the present system, like my grandkids saying, you know, the wheels on the bus go round and round. Well, the wheels on the bus are starting to come off, because they are not going to be able to keep up with crypto. They're not going to be able to keep up with all of these new systems. Why are they looking at a digital currency? It sure as heck isn't because they want to. It's because they want to get rid of cash, so you can't have people evading with cash.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And so, but even if they go to that, as long as you have a system over here with other crypto, they'll have to outlaw that. They're trying, but they'll have to. You're not going to be able to tax it unless you choose to report it. So it's a system that's failing all around the world. And I really think that the states are showing us the futility of trying to continue to put in a failed system when you've actually got to compete. Because remember, the states are like us. They have to live within the money they collect. DC has this idea that those rules don't apply to us. We can just borrow more money. And for a long time, they got away with it. Now, what do they have? The highest inflation in 40 years. And it's not going to go away. You know, they keep raising interest rates. It's going to come down because economic activity is going to come down. People that, I mean, in my neighborhood, people paid for a smaller house probably 150% of what I paid because the, you know, market is so high.
Yeah.
That's going to adjust. I mean, again, Joe may not have lived through this, but I've lived through a number of housing bubbles. And it's going to happen again. Why? Because interest rates going up on a $300,000 loan, that 2.5% is $300 a month. How do most people buy a home on financing? How do they qualify? Based on their income, they're going to have $300 less a month to pay for a house because of interest rates. And they're going to continue to go up. They have to if the Fed raises its rates. So we're talking about a system that's not sustainable. And if we can stick around and we can keep promoting the truth, we're going to see some changes.
Anecdotally, the first house I ever bought, the mortgage rate was 18%. But
yes,
of course, what you were saying, the housing prices were a lot less.
Yes.
I mean, it really doesn't make any difference, right? I mean, these things just adjust one way or the other. And, you know, interest rates come down, housing prices go up, right?
That's right.
You know, it's a pretty simple equation.
It's very simple. And, it, you know, it's supply and demand. Go ahead, Joe. Sorry.
Oh, with the 30 million records being dumped by the IRS, I mean, they do that because they're understaffed. They don't have the time to look through all those records. And they think by getting rid of those records, you know, they just make the job easier. But I see that in the future, it's going to create more problems because 30 million people are going to be accused of tax evasion now because their records are not there in the IRS.
Yep.
So it's going to cause more issues.
Pity the poor people that sent in a return didn't keep a copy. You think that's not usual? It is with a lot of people. And now there's no way to prove anything. All right. So you've got a situation that's pretty crazy. And yes, you know, I had a roommate in college that threw away all of his bills just because he didn't want to confront him. Parking tickets, throw them away. He ended up in jail. I had to go get him out of jail one night. Okay. And so, you know, and that's sort of the attitude a lot of the bureaucrats have, is that if we don't see it, it's not there. And if it's not on our desk to be done, then we don't have, you know, we can go home early. So I've enjoyed it. As I said, I've got another, I have another Zoom call at 12:30. So I'm going to have to hop off in a moment.
I mean, I really want to keep this conversation going with you. Not only do I always learn a lot, I'm reminded of a lot. And I always leave a discussion with you, Steve, with a sense that the world is certainly moving in a better direction. No question about it.
I think it is. And we just have to keep pushing it forward.
More podcasts, more education. The world needs more Steve Hayes.
Well, I appreciate that, John, very much. But I think it needs all three of us.
Yeah, Joe Howard for setting all this up. So on that note, we will leave it. But actually, if you want to get in your coordinates quickly, how would people find out more about the fair?
Absolutely. Day? The best way is to, in today's world, we used to give out phone numbers, but in today's world, it's just go to fairtax.org. We are leading this effort. We're all volunteers, but it does cost money to keep the site up. And the more people that are actually paying members, the more clout that we have when we go to see members of Congress, because that's all they care about is how many people may write them and complain.
How much noise. And Joe, how would people get a hold of you? And before that, would you agree that the Fair Tax would be a great help to Americans abroad?
The Fair Tax Act would be the best help we can get for Americans abroad. It's simple. It's easy to work with. There's nothing to worry about. To get a hold of me, you can email me at american.expatrbt@gmail.com.
That's great. And this is John Richardson closing off another great discussion. So thanks, Steve. Thanks, Joe. And look forward to speaking with you again.